Now, this promises to be an epic. You had to be there. I'm delighted to say Brendan Fanning is with us, rugby journalist, author, chronicler of the history of Irish rugby, not once but twice with Epic Books. Your first one sold gangbusters. I hope the second one is currently selling gangbusters in the Christmas market.
I wish you were right on both. Well, certainly, let's go back to the first gangbusters.
Not so gangbustery?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because I was a complete greenhorn at it. I'd never written a book before, but I knew this was a good idea. And I went, I spoke to a publisher who coincidentally lived quite near me. And we were chatting about it. And I said, look, I know I'm new to this, but I really think this could sell. There's a bit of an appetite for this now. And he said, yeah, I know, but you know what? We don't want to be printing for the warehouse. So
they didn't print enough copies?
No. And then I'll never forget being in Easton's on Christmas Eve, and there was a hole in the top. There was a gap in the top shelf. And I asked one of the shop assistants, I'm looking for a book called From There to Here. And she said, yeah, no, we're out of that.
Oh, no. It's like, great, but what?
And I said, are you getting your delivery like the next hour or whatever? And she said, no, that'll be January.
Oh. So hopefully this time.
Yes, hopefully this time.
You've learned the errors of the way. Yeah. How is it going? Because you were in with Owen talking about the book a couple of weeks ago, and we thought this is a great opportunity to do this piece as well, which is separate but related. How's it going so
far? It's going grand. If I'd written the reviews myself, I couldn't have done any better. And I got a fair slagging over. I was accused of bunging various people to write positive reviews, which is not the case.
There's only restaurants that do that, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's gone grand. And I've in fairness, I copped on early that writing is half the battle, and you had to be prepared to get out and
sell.
So I, with a view to that, I got a couple of corporates to buy a bunch of books, and then I went into schools and did a kind of a Q&A on sports writing and book writing, and left a few books behind, and right, et cetera, et cetera. So that has been interesting.
And is that enjoyable? Did you find that a bit, like, because a lot of people are like, oh no, I've created this thing and now the last thing I want to do is talk about it. But actually it can be somewhat cathartic to birth the child and then see it grow up.
Defo. And I got that, like, it's 50% writing, 50% pushing. So I'm not full-time employed anymore, so I have the time to push.
Right.
And that's fine.
Easier about expected or tougher than you imagined writing a book?
I'm not great on structure, Colm, so it takes me a while to get that together before I kind of turn the key in the ignition. And my battle is not to turn the engine on until I know where I'm going. So I also struggled a bit on the theme for the book, in that I had all these individuals I wanted to write about, and I had all these stories, but putting them into, hooking them up to a theme was a bit tricky. And then by the time I'd finally got all that stuff together, I was up against the clock, and then I had to really kind of lock myself away.
What pressure suits you?
It's funny you should say that. I was doing Ireland, South Africa at the end of the November series for The Guardian, who I worked for years and love working with them. And it was on the whistle. To explain to your listeners, if they don't know, on the whistle means pretty much within a couple of minutes of the final whistle, you're pressing send on your report. So I was doing this, and it was tight enough, and you have to do all the traffic off the bench, and there was a blizzard of bloody cards, which
oh yeah,
made it even more complicated. And I'm thinking, Jesus, do I need this? So I really don't miss that. Book pressure is a different kind of pressure, but it depends to a large degree on the cooperation from people you're approaching. So I was absolutely blessed in that virtually everybody I rang up was prepared to play ball, which is great.
Are you
Andy Farrell wasn't, naturally enough.
Right.
because he had his own book, which nobody's heard of and hasn't sold anything.
There was supposed to be an event in the Borgosh, but I'm not sure. I don't know if it happened or not. Did everybody agree to meet you in person, or can you do this on the phone because you know them quite well over a long time?
It was a
time.
Mix.
Right. Yeah.
There were a lot of people still in the system and established. And so it's important to establish early doors, the ground rules of the conversation.
Yeah.
So some people said, yeah, look, I'm happy to talk off the record, but it just doesn't make any sense for me when I'm still in the system to be getting paid by the IRFU or a subdivision of the IRFU
to be slagging off the IRFU
and making critical comments about them or their ways and means. So that was fine.
Yeah.
And in many ways, actually, it makes for a better bit where we trust you because you've got this track record and you're saying stuff that we can't. We know that somebody would get fired for saying, but actually it's so juicy that it has to go in.
There were some bits I was absolutely gagging to get in and I couldn't.
Right.
And stuff that if you did put it in, you wouldn't want to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out where it was coming from.
Right.
So, and then people would try and say, I see Ger Gilroy in chapter 3.
Yeah.
And if I respond, no, that wasn't Ger, then immediately you're into that game
okay, who else is available?
So you can't do that.
So if you're not great with structure naturally, are you comfortable with the blank page?
I am. One of the Q&As I did in a school recently, a kid asked, how do you get over writer's block? And I said, it's really easy if you're being paid. If you're being paid and you have to do it by a certain amount of time, you get over it.
That's very practical.
Yeah. But I know I enjoy writing. I enjoy talking to people who are happy, who have something to say and are happy to say it. And I enjoy stitching it all together and trying to turn it into a yarn. Like my bottom line would be, if it doesn't have yarnage, don't do it. So if you want to write a thesis on Irish rugby, by all means go and write a thesis on it, but unless you can stitch 20 readable stories into that, don't do it. So I knew that given that this was that Touching Distance is a follow-on to the first book, From There to Here, way back in 2007, I knew that the yarns were there. It was just a question of getting the people to tell them.
Because people want the story, not a stat.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm reading a book now that I won't name, and very well regarded and very, very well researched. And I'm just after getting to the end of a 10-page introduction, and I just had to go for some fresh air because it was just very dense and very heavy. Maybe that's just me.
Oh, no, I think certainly that was the success of the first book, was that there was loads of juice and gossip and also history. It's like this is how it all happened, and it's that brilliant narrative from before to the moment that professionalism happens, and then the aftermath of that, and us finally getting our house together, and then beginning at the foothills of success. The theme emerged eventually, dealing with great expectations. Irish rugby's battle with great expectations is the subheading to the title. Was that? Did that emerge over the course of it? It's like, oh, I see what our problem is here.
I tell you how it emerged. I got knocked back by a publisher who said, you know, look, I don't doubt that you've got all these good stories, but we don't think there's a theme. We think there's a great book there, but, you know, we don't see the theme. And I said, you know what, you're right. So let me go off and reworked it, thought I had the theme, came back to them. And then suddenly, well, first of all, I was being ghosted, which really pissed me off.
Yeah.
So eventually I nailed this guy down, and he was being very evasive. And I just said, and he said, yeah, okay, right, Brendan. He said, you like straight talking, I'll give it to you straight. We just don't think it's good enough. I said, okay, the pity you didn't tell me that way at the start before you sent me off to rework the theme. And as it turned out, he was 100% right. It did need a theme, and I was, and it is good enough, and I was happy that I had it right, but I was really pissed off with the way that was handled, when I suspect that person may have just got a book that they thought would sell more, And if they'd said, and if this was the case, you know what, sorry, another bus has come along and we're going to catch that one. That's the business.
Mm. Did you share that frustration?
Did I share it with him?
Yeah.
Yes. But that'd be my nature. Wouldn't
yeah.
be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The yarnage thing is really interesting wording. Because is it really tempting to be self-satisfied with a very well-crafted sentence and a grammatically perfect paragraph when you're writing? And like, oh, that reads really well. But I don't know what actually this does for a story. Is
if you've other people reading for you, and I do, and I did in this,
yeah.
you know, they wouldn't be slow to say, no, you're disappearing up your own derriere there. You need to just, and one guy in particular is really, really good. And he would say, is this really necessary?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
And the answer to which was no, it's not, so that it has to go.
Yeah, well, that's fair. There's you need those friends in your life, yeah. don't you?
Oh, you do, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you be able to spot a person who has the ability to write a book? Like, it's not for everyone who's a sports journalist, are they able to write a sports book?
I'd be able to spot an athlete who has a story to tell. I'm not sure about the other one. You know the old adage, everyone has a book in them.
Yeah.
And for some people, it should stay there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a hard one to answer.
Kind of. It is. But
were you hoping that he could look at you and go, yeah, you've got one in
no,
you?
No. Sure, we only met in here for the first time.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry I haven't been answering your emails.
Yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. I don't mind being ghosted personally. It's all right. Yeah, but it's just, it fascinates me because it's, I wouldn't say the thankless task because you get sold out in Easton if it works well. But like, it is, I imagine it's a lonely endeavour at the same time, writing a book. That there is something.
Well, I'll put it this way. I was made redundant by the end of about a year and a half ago. And my kind of rough business plan now would be to write a book every couple of years.
All right.
And the pace of writing a book is much more appealing than being a hamster on the wheel as a regular sports journalist, even though there were other hamsters who were treading far quicker than I was. I like the book writing thing works. It suits me.
You ghosted Willie Anderson's book, is that right?
Yes.
Anybody else's? Or is that the...
No, just that's the third.
Okay, yeah.
I had a couple of offers, requests from publishers to do other people along the way, and either the money was crap or the subject wasn't very interesting.
Right. Mm. That's and if a you're gonna bad ghost, combination.
If you're going to ghost somebody, it's brilliant if both boxes are ticked, yeah. but you must have one of them.
Yeah.
And Willie was just amazing. He was fantastic.
And is that something you would do again then? It's not
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
To my math, it's a very, very basic question. How does that work, ghosting a book?
I sit down with you, so you're a GA star I'd happily do another sport.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have to be rugby. And you'd meet and we'd come to an agreement or an arrangement where I sit down with you and it could be 10 hours, could be 20 hours over X number of weeks and a load of phone calls. And depending on your age and your memory, and in Willie's case, because Willie is a good age and we were talking about stuff that happened 30 and 40 years ago, I had to do a lot of scurrying off and I'm ringing Ger Gilroy and saying, Willie says in 1982, the period you were stopped by the police in West Belfast and coming from an Ulster game, does that make sense to you? And you go, oh God, I remember that. Or, nah, that never happened.
Right.
So there's a lot of legwork. But while it was enervating, it was also entertaining because a lot of these people, certainly in Willie's book, had all stories to tell and loved the idea of going back down memory lane.
Yeah.
So that was great.
Can we talk a bit about the state of the game at the moment? Because it's changed significantly in the last number of years and there's several of your generation who have stepped away from the day-to-day or week-to-week sports writing And it looks like there's going to be a significant number of people stepping away in the next 18 months. We've just seen loads of people at Reach let go as well. What's your instinctive response when people ask you, what's the game of sports writing like at the moment?
I was always very mindful, and Sean Moran of the Irish Times would be a good pal of mine for many years, and we'd be having a whinge and a moan about travelling here or there or trying to get copy in.
He's doing this slot next week.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay. I remember Sean always saying, you know, if you buy a Mars bar, you never see a note on the back from the fellow who's on the production line saying, my seat is really hard, I'd really like a comfy seat. So if you're travelling around the world, as I was lucky to do because rugby is an international game, and staying in decent hotels and never paying into a match and getting a decent seat. So there's a, okay, if there's a couple of downsides, keep them to yourself. That said, it is, I think it's increasingly hard to get good stuff out of athletes because for two reasons. One, they're coached not to say anything because nobody wants it's something up in the dressing room wall of the opposition changing room saying those guys are crap and whatever. And I get that. And the other thing is that a lot of the people we're talking to have never had any experience of life outside of pro sport. Mm. So they were in the academy at the age of, they were on a select group from the age of 16 or 17, and then they were in academy by the time they were 18 or 19. They've always been on the diet. They've always been on the program. You know, they're part-time jobs. Yeah, they might have worked in their local off-license or whatever, but they don't have really much to say. So that can be hard, trying to generate copy from somebody who doesn't have much to say. So I don't miss that.
Is there a third problem too, in that now sports stars are chatting with each other on podcasts? And they're more comfortable with each other because they know each other and they trust that person. So you're more likely to get a more truthful, entertaining story as a result.
Absolutely. And they're being paid for the podcast and we aren't paying them. So all the people sports people I would have interviewed over the years, I wasn't paying anybody. And the media days where all the bun fight organised for in any of the provinces or the international, there's no money changing hands.
Yeah.
At the same time, in the gaps in between tournaments, these players will be all sponsored and they'll have a commercial day. So the window opens again. But they're saying the same stuff again. Now they're getting paid by the sponsor, and the window is open to the journals to come in and harvest a couple of quotes. But generally it's unexciting. And that's another reason why writing a book is easier, because people are more givish if it's not coming out tomorrow or if it's not coming out on Sunday.
Yeah.
They say, oh, this is for a book. When is the book? Well, probably be next year. Oh, yeah, Grant.
That's interesting, yeah.
Off they go.
To your second point about sports people aren't telling us anything anymore, will that change, do you think?
No.
Won't?
No, it's not in their interest to. Initially, the way it used to work was, so you're a GA star or whatever, and you're 18 or 19 and you've just got onto the senior mm-hmm. team, and I ring you up and he goes, oh, Brendan Fanning for the Sunday, you know, geez, I'm going to be in the paper on Sunday. That didn't last very long. By the time you're 20, it's, oh, Christ, not the media. Because the older guys, the change room, will immediately tear strips out of you being a media tart, and then you need to wise up, son, and don't be trusting those guys. And it is a given that some of the people in the changing room won't like the journal you're talking to.
Right. Are they, in your experience, are they right to have a mistrust or suspicion of the media?
I think you'd be mad not to be cautious. But I think the level of media education, for the want of a better word, with players is wanting. Other jurisdictions are better than we are. The Aussies are better.
The South Africans, certainly their coaching, they're totally open. Like, we can get John Dobson on the phone anytime. Yeah. Now, in fairness, Stuart Lancaster will talk to us. But everybody else, like, it has to be fairly well organized in advance, and everything is run through in terms of access. And I've been told that the South Africans just feel like media, the market is small enough. If they can help grow the market and get eyeballs on their sport, they appreciate the fact that it's part of the gig. I don't think, I think the other thing is that it's kind of a lack of coaching, where I'm going to rely exclusively on, they said something bad about you and that's why we're going to win this game this week. Like, I'm not really sure that works. Lark Corbett famously did a double page spread in the Sunday Times and went out and scored a hat-trick in an All-Ireland final. And we all thought, this is great. Everybody's going to want to do the press for the All-Ireland hurling final. Didn't work out that way, unfortunately.
Okay, well, you mentioned you're having Sean in next week, asking about press nights. I'd be very interested to hear if his version of press nights that he gives you is the same that he gives me. I think the number one hate among GAA corps in this country is the press night.
Put me down for what I said last year. That's the famous line from one of the Kerry lads. You can put me down for what I said last year, I'll see his.
I remember the late, we're back to rugby, Carl Johnson, who was instrumentally getting me into this business in the first place, are helpful. Really great guy, died a good number of years ago. Carl was in the press for years, wrote on rugby and cricket and various other things. And Carl was under pressure once to deliver a piece for a magazine on a specific Ireland player, and he couldn't get a hold of him. So he made up the quotes.
Oh.
So after he filed it, whatever, he eventually got a hold of the guy and he said, look, by the way, you know, I had to do this piece. And your man goes, Jesus, okay, what did you say? So Carl read it back and he says, ah, yeah, that sounds about right. So that was it. And Carl was able to get on to it. Yeah, let it run. We're fine. We're okay. He's happy with it.
Happy times.
Yeah.
It's like one of the biggest rivalries in sport is media versus the athletes or sports people.
Yeah.
And they'll always be on different teams. Because, like, because we, you know, the big thing you get criticized, oh, like, you know, if they ever show a Vincent Brown clip or if it's on your algorithm, it's like, oh, bring back Vincent Brown. Like, you know,
don't bring back. I worked for Vincent Brown in the Sunday Tribune. Don't bring him back.
But you know what I mean? People love it because, like, oh, he's being real hard on the guest and, like, you know, he's asking the tough questions. No one asks any tough questions anymore. It's like, okay, cool. We'll play your game. We'll ask really tough questions. And then the athlete or sports person is going to be alienated by your, what are you attacking me for? I'm not going to talk to you again.
I remember coming out of a Celtic League or Pro 14 or Pro 12, whatever it was, bun fight, the start of the season, where all the clubs are there with coaches and whoever, and we all rock up. So we were on the same flight home, I think it was in Cardiff or whatever, and I'm walking down the stairs and I fall in step with Leo Cullen on the way down, and we're waiting to get onto the apron to walk over to the plane, and we're kind of, oh yeah. And Leo looks at me and he goes, well, a no-score draw? Did you? That's about right. That about sums it up. So,
did you ever mind about getting people on side, so to speak?
Sorry, explain a bit more.
Like, was it important for you to build a relationship with the people that you interviewed or you spoke with, whether it's coaches or players or staff, or did you prioritise the story, so to speak? Now, maybe it's more nuanced than that. There's a bit of both and everything, but I guess. If you build a rapport, one theory will be, well, then it's easier to get the story as a result.
It is. But then that leads you down a kind of a dangerous route, in that rapport is a short step away from being too pally with them, and then you're in trouble. But I would have written stories with people who I had no relationship with and who really didn't like me. And you just get on with it. Yeah. You accept that you're not going to get anything particularly good out of it, but it just has to be done.
Was there a sweet spot in terms of an era?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd say the early days of professionalism, when nobody knew what was going on. They didn't know what end was up or what day of the week it was. They were likely to say anything, and there was all sorts of stuff going on with making up contracts and then drugs and all of that stuff.
Late 90s, this is.
Yes, yeah. That was great. And it was just one car crash after another. The IFU were in a tailspin, and it was a really good time to be writing about the game. Really good. The results were horrendous, but that was just a little hiccup. The copy that we got from that. At the time, I was on the circuit, myself and Peter O'Reilly, who's a close friend of mine, and Tom English, Tom, who's been off in Scotland for
20 years we
yeah, God, it's a lot. Yeah. So the three of us would have done a lot of travelling together and a lot of drinking together and a lot of laughing.
Tom
and
getting punched in the jacks, of course. Yeah,
I remember
the manager. Yeah,
I tell you a story about that. We came home from we were down doing an AIL game in Limerick, and we were going down the quays, myself and Tom, and we stopped in for a pint somewhere, and I'd done a what I thought was a really decent piece on Brian Ashton the next day, and, you know, asking the IRA review the hard questions and whatever. And I was delighted with myself, and Tom says, we were in the Horse and Tram, if you remember the Horse and Tram. And Tom says, yeah, I did something as well, and just kind of played it down. So off we went home, and I opened the Sunday Times the next day, and Tom had this like whopper of a piece, which just put mine completely in the shade. So that the laugh we got out of that over the coming weeks, and the incident, you know, that I mean, how many countries have had an incident where a national team manager gives a journo a dig in the jacks of a nightclub? Like, only in Ireland.
It does sound kind of Eastern European football from the 70s. That might have had some similar...
Interestingly, you know. The same manager, when I approached him, when I was writing the first book, and I couldn't really do it without talking to him.
Yeah.
And I didn't think he would cooperate, and he did. And I drove down to Limerick, and he was pretty good. He wouldn't talk about that specific thing.
Yeah.
But he was happy to yak about everything else.
That bit at the Tribune, how long are you there working with Vincent Brown? Because there's definitely a seam of talent that comes through, particularly in the sports department, around the same time. And it's the foundational bit of every other good thing that happens in Irish sports journalism for about 20 years afterwards. What period of that were you there?
86 to 91, generally. Right. And then Sunday Times. Luckily, I jumped on board in there. The late, great Alan Ruddock, who was the business editor on the Sunday Tribune, then became the editor of the Sunday Times in Ireland, and he was pushing that. And I got on with Alan, and I said, you know what, you need to tip your hat to rugby. That's your man.
Right.
And Ireland were sending a development tour to...
Namibia?
Correct, to Africa.
Right.
Namibia, Zimbabwe and South Africa. And I said, you want to cover that? And the Tribune, I knew I wouldn't send me because they didn't have the money.
Yeah.
And he said, Ruddock was brilliant. And he'd be leaning back in the chair with a Marlboro light in one hand and his feet on the desk. And he goes, oh yeah, okay, let's do it. Yes. So he gave me a contract.
Right.
Yeah.
And stay there for three very happy years. And then Ian O'Sullivan, a great guy to work for, was the Sunday Indo sports editor. So he came in and I went over to the Sindo.
And were you rugby correspondent at the Sindo straight away?
Yep.
Yeah, right. That is kind of the golden era of the Tribune, where everybody was working. Like that, their World Cup coverage in Italia 90 was kind of legendary. They
produced it was crazy.
Those,
I remember that vividly.
The binder that you would get, you'd build it up week by week, and the whole country was buying the paper. Yeah. I mean, that's what it felt like. I mean, in retrospect, nobody was buying the paper really compared with the other ones, and it was losing a million a week or something ridiculous at the time, but you could see it.
The Tribune was a brilliant place to be. It was edge of the seat the whole time, and it was classic. It was volatile. And Vincent Brown thrived in chaotic
Wild.
Situations. Yeah. So he would sort of, frankly, behave quite badly in creating that chaos. But what a place to learn, you know.
Yeah.
And there was no demarcation. Like, I would have been familiar with Burkey and doing stuff in the press. And if you sat in the wrong seat, if you sat in a compositor's seat rather than a journo's seat, there'd be a walk. So the Tribune, everybody was kind of mucking in, and you could walk over to where the paper's been put together and have a chat to that guy, and it was just brilliant.
Yeah.
When was the turn then, you know, if like the sweet spot was the start of the professional era, was the change where it wasn't as good? Was that gradual?
It was gradual, and the better we got, I suppose, the degree to which things were tightened up.
Mm.
And it's still, you know, it's not the worst way to earn a living by any means, but it's just not as kind of free and easy as it used to be.
It's kind of almost trying now to say it, that, like, print is really in trouble and there'll be no newspapers in a few years' time. But, like, what is your level of concern for the industry?
Now that I'm not in it? not that much. I wish they got the model right earlier online.
Charging for content.
And got everything away for free.
Yeah, and got people back to themselves so that people would appreciate the jets is worth paying for. And that didn't happen. And once that genie was out of the box, it was hard to fix it. I think the Sunday newspaper market is certainly more resistant than the dailies. And I think there is still an element of people taking a bit of time out on a Sunday and liking the feel of a paper in their hand. But yeah, Jesus, the dailies wouldn't look great now.
If a young person went up and asked you, well, I want to be a sports journalist when I get into
it. Yeah, so when you're doing these readings at the moment, and they do ask you that question, I'm sure.
Well, I say, look, don't get hung up on print. You're all journalists. You all have phones. You can go and watch a match now if you're into sport. You can do a match report on it. You can get your buddies to read it. And if they think, yeah, that's not bad, well, post it. Put it online. Mm-hmm. We didn't have that platform. Yeah. You know, you had to be a card-carrying member of the NUJ to get in.
Oh, I remember ringing up and they'd be like, yeah, we'll send you. Have you got an NUJ card? And I'm like, no. And then you'd ring the NUJ and they're like, you need two people to recommend you. Yeah. Or you need to have done some work. I'm like, but they won't give me any work if I can't do
it. Yeah, it was the Catch-22.
Yeah.
That's where Carl Johnson came in for me, in that I got in through PR. There was a PR branch to the NUJ.
Right.
And that I got it that way. But yeah, I would say to kids, absolutely, the standards may not be as good as they were when I was starting out, and that people were reading your copy and they were telling you, don't say that, that's rubbish, or whatever.
You mean sub-editors?
Yes.
And an editor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that whole, now it's like
the days of the sub-editors. Yeah, seems,
a good sub.
Gone.
My yeah. God, a good sub is a godsend.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the other extreme as well. but nowadays they have, you know, you can, and if you're good, if you can write, you'll be spotted.
Yeah.
So yeah, go for it, kids.
Will we get into these?
Yeah, let's do it.
This list is from 1970 all the way up to 2009. Are you a Celtic fan?
Yes.
Yeah. Always?
Yeah, I'm not much now. I was a Celtic nut back then, which was a bit of a battle because it was single channel land.
Yeah.
But
did you grow up in Clontarf? Was Clontarf?
Yes, and we spent all our lives playing as kids. Everything was done out on the road.
Right.
We played every game there was to play, and there was a mob of us always playing on the road. And there was a Scottish guy in Diggs, moved in Diggs across the road, and he got me onto Celtic. And he gave me a book by a fellow called Ian Peebles called Celtic Triumphant, which was about 1967 and the mm-hmm. Lisbon Lions. And I became a Celtic nut. So Fine Erd, 1970, and we were off playing football down the promenade as usual, home in good time to watch this game. And it got to 90 minutes, scores are 1-1, and Orty went to the news and didn't come back.
The second leg of extra time in European Cup.
In Milan, I think it was. So that was the end of it. As far as I was concerned, we were all just left hanging. And I genuinely did not know, find out the result until the next morning. And a neighbour told me. And that was my first experience of heartbreak with sport. Mm. I was gutted, absolutely gutted.
And bad TV decisions.
Yeah.
That was crazy, yeah. I do like your accompanying note with the fact that RT didn't show extra time.
Yeah.
Because it must have felt like that. But they beat Leeds en route in the semi-final.
They did, and that was great because in the early 70s, most lads were Chelsea or Leeds.
Mm.
You know, Don Revie's Leeds were the...
Yeah.
They were the big ones, so... For Celtic to beat them in both legs of the semi was fantastic.
And was football your first love?
Yes.
Ahead of rugby even?
Absolutely. Not till I went to St. Paul's rugby school, kind of, back then. And I was mad into GA as well. I played GA in Belgrove in school.
Okay, so in school in Belgrove, Clontarf GA club or?
Yeah, that came later because there was no minis back then. George.
Right, okay. So
and no youth rugby either.
Yeah.
You either played in school and then your first involvement with your club would have come after school.
Right.
Which is mad to think now, but that's the way it was.
Yeah. And that has been the great sea change in Irish sport and actually making everybody good at stuff by getting them playing earlier.
Yeah.
Tommy Gemmell got the Celtic goal.
That's right.
Left back.
And I thought, that's it, sorted 1-0. It'll be 2 or 3.
Hadn't heard of Feyenoord.
Yeah. David Hay, who was a...
Yeah.
He was a fullback, cornerback.
suppose he wouldn't have, yeah.
No, he said after, he was quoted, and he said, I'd never heard of him. Right.
Well, it sounds preposterous now.
He wasn't alone.
But I get it. Like, this is 1970.
I had an excuse, though. I was 9. Yeah.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. 7 years later, choice number 2, 1977.
Dublin,
Kerry in the All-Ireland Semi.
1974, a whole generation of Dublin teenagers were suddenly turned on to GAA because Dublin's previous win would have been 1963, which is not that long ago if you look at it now, but back then it was an eternity. So everybody was stitched into the Dubs, and getting into Hill 16 was the place to be. And in 77, they were not being bet out the gate, but they were. It looked like they were going down the pan, and they resurrected themselves. And John McCarthy, who was a really good corner forward, scored, and Dave Hickey scored a brilliant goal into the hill where we were. And coincidentally, a few years later, Dave Hickey came and spent a couple of seasons in Clontarf, and I got to play with him.
Right, okay, because he played in La Rochelle as well.
He did, yeah. And that came about. He was a kidney surgeon, and he went to work in a hospital in Bordeaux, and La Rochelle was down the road. So he actually played for La Rochelle, and then we organised a trip over to La Rochelle, Clontarf, to play La Rochelle.
Right.
So Dave was playing for them. He's a great bloke.
He is.
It was like, brilliant to play with him.
You know, one of those kind of leaders of the country quietly.
And, yeah.
Almost imperceptibly. And then you realise, oh, hang on a second, this guy's had an incredible impact on Irish society over a long period of time. And was that Dublin team, as a supporter, was it as visceral an experience as it is that we assume it is now looking back, where you're like, it's the birth of the modern day Dubs, it's Heffo, and it's that parade of characters. Like all of them, in every line, they have people who have gone on to be important in the public's imagination. If you've got any interest in GAA, you know, Keaveney, Brian Mullins, I'm trying to think of some of the others, Paddy Cullen, like they just became massive characters. Were they actually at the time? Did you realise that, hang on a second, there's a collection of very special people here?
Yeah, and they became more special thanks to David Walsh doing a brilliant piece, which would be classified as a very long read nowadays, in McGill magazine on those players. And I say it could have been like 1,200 words on each one of them, which is a big chunk.
Oh, yeah.
And it became, you know, like a huge piece at the time. But I remember reading that thinking, wow, that, you know, really good sports writing, but also what a great insight into these fellas.
Mm. And is it around then that you're starting to think about becoming a sports writer?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure, I'm not sure when that piece was done. But yeah, it would have, certainly would have woken me up.
And was it a fairly straightforward career path, notwithstanding the fact that you needed somebody to get you into the NUJ through the PR wing, but like the bit before that where you're like, I have talent in this, I could do this, I'm interested in it?
Well, there was a lot of running around doing score and brief, as it was called. So you go to a Leinster League game and you do the bare bones, and you'd be filing it into the, ringing it into the Sindo, into the Sunday Press.
Okay.
And then the Tribune, when the Tribune came along.
So at least you got three people paying you.
Yeah, yeah. And a pittance, but still. And my break came by being in Skerries one day. I was reporting on Skerries against Mary's in a Leinster League game. Mary's needed to score some avalanche of points in order to win, and they did.
Right.
And suddenly
they wanted a match report.
A report with a 300 word report and a byline. So I said, you know,
happy days.
Absolutely.
The final that year was forgettable. Armagh.
Yeah, Armagh. It was memorable, Colm, for if you're on Hill 16, the Cusick, the Canal and the Hogan were entirely orange. Yeah. Like, or saffron. No.
That's orange, right? Yeah. So, saffron's antrim, yeah.
So there was a absolute army of lads came down from Armagh, and it was fantastic spectacle. But they were beaten at the gate.
Yeah. I just remember looking back at these games in the 70s and 80s, and it always felt like the hill was like dodgily packed.
Ah.
Oh, yo, no.
You know what I mean?
It was dangerous. It was absolutely.
But I was worried that was going to be too much of a word to use, dangerous.
No,
but
it was terrifying.
Really?
Yeah. If you were caught, I think it's St. James's Avenue leads down to the hill, but there'd be people screaming at them to open the gates. And I was in a crush there a couple of times, and you had no power to go anywhere. You were wherever the sea of people was going, that's where you were going. And eventually, remember one day the gates were opened and we all got in, and a lot of people were on the grassy bank leading up to the hill. It was very dangerous.
It's like talk about the professionalism now of it, quote unquote. Like, I mean, the idea of rocking up to an All-Ireland final now and hoping to get in, like, is absolutely laughable considering how far in advance you need to get your ticket. But then it's amazing hearing those stories, because I've heard it repeatedly, that a major incident didn't occur.
I can't... I've said this to lots of people over the years, that it was just, I don't know, the grace of God or...
a miracle.
It was a miracle.
Yeah.
That, because you were, on occasions, you were lifted off the ground.
Yeah.
And you had no control, absolutely none. So... you know, and if you were the man who's deciding, do I open the gates, do I not open the gates?
I know. Yeah,
if you remember at Ibrox, that was, I think, down, people were leaving, then turned to get back in.
Yeah.
Like, God, when it goes wrong, it goes horribly wrong.
Tony Hannahoe was the player manager of that team in 77, by the way, that it's like a completely ridiculous level of achievement that, you know, Kenny Dalglish managed it and very few others, but he was another character.
So it's rugby from here on out, the last three choices. You always stay in touch, though, with every other sport that you loved growing up, didn't you?
Well, I fell out of love with football.
Did you?
Yeah. And to the point now that I don't watch much of it. I can't get my head around the willful cheating.
Well, I was going to ask why, but I had a suspicion. Yeah.
That's why.
It's tough. It's tough to your journey as a football watcher to go from... the encouragement to stay on your feet versus the encouragement now to go down.
Yeah.
If you don't go down. We had John Moss, you know, the former Premier League referee.
Yeah.
We had him on the show a few weeks ago, and I says, if players don't go down, you're not going to give the penalty. And he said, yeah. You don't want to be that ref.
Mm. I battled with that. And the degree of acceptance from commentators who know the game infinitely better than I do. And they were just... because these instances are just so common,
yes,
they just let a big chunk of them go without saying that's bang out of order.
That is definitely something I had spotted and hadn't vocalised, is it's the same people 20 years ago that were complaining that the player's gone down easy. They're saying, no, that's a foul. That's a foul. And it's like, oh, there was contact. A leg was put out. It's smart, but it is a penalty.
Yeah.
You hear that a lot now.
Yeah.
I suppose you either accept it and embrace it because you will... drive yourself insane otherwise if
also,
you're watching the game.
I found the referee abuse bad. The pursuit of referees by 2, 3, 4 players running after a guy.
Manchester then, United.
Pardon me?
That's Roy Keane in Manchester United. That famous
David Elbery. The Middlesbrough one,
yeah.
I don't think it's David Elbery, but yeah, the...
Was that Andy Dirk?
Dirk, yeah, I think you're right.
And I guess football authorities just reckon this is part of the spectacle. We're going to admonish people, but we're going to let it go.
Now, do you think you'd ever think that the rugby culture could actually transfer into football seamlessly, in that, like, it's total opposite with rugby referees? There's a constant conversation and dialogue, but that's because of the way the game is played, isn't it?
Rugby culture. This whole idea of not talking back to the referees. Mm. Rugby was given a lot of credit for that. There's a lot of it going on now.
Talking back?
Yeah, at youth level. And probably, I'm sure, at club, at senior level as well. But it's not as bad as other sports. And incidents of assault of referees, I think, are very few and far between.
Mm. Mm. All right, so rugby it is. 1985, Cardiff.
Yeah.
This was special because they hadn't won there in a long time.
That's right.
18 years, is it?
My growing up, falling in love with rugby, Cardiff was our graveyard. And I remember games, tuning in and praying, oh, this will be the day. And of course, didn't happen. And then 85, everything worked. And not only did it work, the quality of rugby that they played was just exhilarating.
Keith Crossan's try.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a barbarian stuff.
And a lot of it was down to Paul Dean at out half. And 3 years earlier, Ireland had won a Triple Crown in 82 with Ollie Campbell flying the plane, and Ollie was the best ever for us. And some of the rugby was really good, but this was just a different level. And we stopped being a kick and chase team and became a running and passing team, and it was great to watch.
The difference in that style of play, it's funny because a new team comes along, the Rob Saunders, Brian Smith, that short period where the team had been beaten and battered out the gate. And then they started to play, and Simon Gagan, obviously, they started to play great rugby. And I think that was another kind of, isn't it better when we play like this as opposed to the 10-man game where we kick to the corners and hope that we might fall over the line a couple of times?
But it's dictated by the players at your disposal. And a consistent fault with the IRFU was their comfort. And it persists to a degree, not as much as back then. They're happy with what they have, and we'll see what that produces rather than being very aggressive. And just to go back to the book for a moment, that is the part of the theme is we really need to be shaking every tree and you know, turning over every stone to see where we can get players of difference.
Mm. And the thing is that loads of other countries are doing it. Like I've been banging on ever since the All Blacks started to send their players away for a sabbatical or give them time off. I was like, well, we should do this. Like, we actually have loads of players who need to make it every step of the way. And 5 years ago, we could have done it with Tadhg Furlong, and then you'd have depth in that position. We could certainly be doing it now with our out halves, given the third and fourth choice out halves, 25 games in the Prem or in the top 14 or in Super Rugby. There's no sign of it. There's no sign of them thinking like this.
We should be certainly willing to loan players out as well. I know Ron Rogar was pretty keen to get his hands on Jack Crowley a couple of years ago. And O'Gara would always be having a good look around. And the IRFU should be definitely open to that.
Why are they not, do you think?
Possibly because they don't want to have the row with Leo Cullen if the lad is coming out of Leinster, or Stuart Lancaster if the lad's coming out of Connacht or wherever it is. But that's down to David Humphreys. I mean, you know, he's the new Noosa Forest. So if he thinks it's very important, and believe me, Humphreys has got his hands full on this X factor search and this developing more players, because he's looking at the other three provinces outside of Leinster and realizing that they're not functional on that side of the fence.
Yeah. Many problems for him to fix all at once. But like that is also the gig, though, right?
Well, you know, World Cups come every 4 years, so there's no sitting still.
No.
And as you know, that is our metric, recurring metric.
On the theme of expectations, is it that the IRFU don't have higher expectations? That the fans, the supporters, the players all have very high expectations, but that the committees, the professional game committee, the executives are like, what are you talking about? We're doing great. We're making loads of money. Everything is great. The numbers are great.
Well, they are doing great relative to our old Celtic cousins in Wales and Scotland, with whom reasonably we would compare ourselves. And they'd be getting on to us saying, Jesus, what is it about the Irish system? You know, we'll have to do a piece on the Irish system this week, the Ajax of rugby, you know.
Yeah.
The problem is, and we have become victims of our own success to a degree, is that it induces a degree of comfort. Well, look at it. We've done this. We're winning all around. It's the only thing we haven't done.
How much more do you want?
Is last. Exactly. So there's no urgency. And where you don't have urgency, you end up pretty much standing still.
But is that level of comfort because we can only fix the one thing that's left over every 4 years?
No. The level of comfort column is because all our provinces have won something at some point, and our national team are stacking up Six Nations and Grand Slams. And we are clearly, relative to our size, pretty good at what we do.
Mm.
So, for my money, we need to be more urgent about getting that last step sorted, and we're not.
It's an amazing journey, though, isn't it? Because 30 years ago, it would be kind of laughable to suggest that Ireland would be the world number one team in rugby.
But you would have been laughed at.
Short period of time.
If you go back further, you would have been laughed out the gate if you thought rugby would be a professional game. So, like mid-80s.
Yeah, well, this is happening, yeah.
When we were winning that triple crown in 1985, nobody was saying,
this game needs to go professional.
Will go pro. You would have, no, not a chance.
Yeah.
And partly that was because the IRFU didn't just frown on professionalism, it was just bad. It was bad business.
Do you think that the design of the IRFU as it improved as the 21st century progressed vindicated finishing or eventually being world number one? Or did it?
I know, they did change.
Like they planned that. And that is the end goal, no?
They were dragged kicking and screaming into it. And they kept the handbrake up for a few years and only put the handbrake down when the RGs beat us in Lawns in 1999. And they said, oh, hang on a sec. Like, There's no lads. I know this is ideologically obnoxious for us, but we're going to have to get on board with this. Let's take it seriously.
Some people might have to get paid for this. On the world number one thing, though, like it's not really a thing. Like it's a thing.
But it's up to you whether to take it seriously or not.
But we shouldn't take it seriously when the World Cup is actually a real thing. That they give a trophy out to the best team in the world.
Yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't give you a head start in a game.
No.
And there isn't you don't get a bonus from World Rugby for being number one. It's a reflection of where you are at the time. And if it's number one, then it's great to say, yeah, we are in this position, which rapidly becomes, Jesus, how do we stay here?
It'd be like saying Arsenal are the best team in England at the moment, but until they actually win the league.
No, that's different, I think.
I think the world number one thing is something.
Arsenal have won the first half of the Premier League season, which you get nothing for that.
Very slow about talking about it as an achievement if I was the IRFU. But are we the best team in the world? It's like, you're not.
But they got to world number one for, you know, it was the performance in the Six Nations and winning Grand Slams and winning tours. Like, there was actual tangible reasons that they got there. It's just the one thing's eluding us, which everyone talks about. Every rugby doubter points to the quarterfinal of the World Cup. Straight away. You win all these meaningless friendlies in the meantime.
But that's a good point. All the rugby doubters do. But everybody in rugby should also point to that and say, we can't settle. We need to be restless.
An interesting point here with the rugby doubters, of whom there are quite a few, and they all stand up when we bomb at a quarterfinal of a World Cup. And it's not very pleasant. You know? And I wonder, why do you think that is? Why are there so many people who... I have a theory on this, but I'm not sure if it stands up. What's yours?
Class.
Yeah.
Total class.
Yeah, okay. Snobbery. Fair enough. Yeah, private school game.
Yeah, inverted snobbery. Yeah. But also, yeah, like, we don't belong. There's a very popular slogan to do with the rugby team, and I think people laugh at it.
I would have thought that we haven't burst that bubble, but I thought we had made enough progress in getting non-private school fellas at the top end of the game that it would have helped.
Well, Keith Earls is an amazing story, and like there are definitely exceptional,
but they shouldn't be
examples.
It should be broader. Now the private schools have done an unbelievably good job in producing these players, but it just makes no sense not to be tapping up everybody else.
Yeah, it's true.
No
sense. It's true. And I think, to be honest, if the balance was in favour of Munster and Connacht and Ulster, that would help. There's a very It's centralised in Dublin. The team is a Dublin team.
Yeah.
And so it's harder for the casual sports fans to get on board with that, because they feel like there's a distance between them, real or imagined. And all those things feed into it. But on the verge of the team winning the last quarter final at home, a home World Cup in France, there was a moment there, if they got over that I think that would have crossed over. And the viewership figures were massive for that. So they had crossed over, and the doubters were being silenced. But they roared back.
Did they what?
Just when I thought you...
A lot of match-going fans would be very critical of the Irish team. I don't think it's just the doubters that would self-analyse and reflect on underperformance or stagnation.
The supporters, perhaps, I think. But I think the point is that the IRFU need to be radical in getting new talent and X-factor players. And if that means you go off to the islands and you induce families to move over here who are good, or you get into South Africa and you recruit 16-year-old
props. Just go to the GA.
Yeah,
that's it. You know?
Yeah. Just look at the Limerick hurling team. Five or 6 years of unbelievably physically developed, talented, uber-competitive athletes. And you watch, every time I would watch that Limerick team over the last 5 or 6 years, I'd be pigeonholing fellas in various positions on a rugby field. And the same with the Dubs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. James McCarthy would have been some player.
Yeah.
They're still raving about Fenton's impact from the one session he did with them for how to catch the ball over the head.
The penultimate entry, 1997, Lions Tour, second test in Durban.
That was one of those days when you would generally say, God, this is the best job in the world. I can't believe I'm sitting here and I haven't paid a penny to get in. And the South Africa were in a bit of a state. And the thing about that tour was nobody was sure. That was the first Lions tour of the pro era. The gate had only opened 2 years earlier. Nobody was sure where the game was going or if the Lions would have a place in it. Would other countries be happy to give their players to go on the Lions, knowing that they might not come back for 6 months, banged up, etc., etc.? And to win that series was just fantastic. And the atmosphere that day, they had the part of the pre-match just kind of enter stage left. About 150 Zulus in costume came out. And it wasn't you pay your 10 bob and you go into a tourist attraction and there are a couple of Zulus. This was absolutely hair on the back of the neck stuff. It was scary. And the atmosphere was unreal. And it probably helped that it was in Durban, which is King's Park in Durban, which is an unbelievably sheer, both stands are incredibly sheer. And you feel if you stand up, you're going to go over the edge. So it all added to this. And then the Lions went and won the game. So it was just the perfect story.
What was, could you elaborate actually on what was so special being there in terms of everything to do with that, the atmosphere in that stadium, because the sense of danger with the sheer fall potentially, but was like, what would be the words you'd use to describe that day that you're feeling watching the game?
Well, a few things. You're really on edge.
Yeah.
Because you have a certain job to do, and I can't remember what my gig was that day or what time, whether it was filing on the whistle. No, it wouldn't have been filing on the whistle. But it all builds up. And South Africa is a very intimidating place when it comes to rugby. And I've been down there in 1993 mm-hmm. on the Ireland Development Tour. So I had a good look around and I got a good sense of what it meant to them. And I remember as a kid watching the Lions down there in 74, little snippets on the box and getting a good feel for the Saffras and what rugby was about. So they were very angry after losing the first test. So the atmosphere was absolutely full on and it was just great to be witnessing it and feeling a little bit of pressure yourself that you got it right.
That tour has gone down, I think, for future generations primarily because of the quality of the documentary that gets produced, and there's this feeling at least that everything is quite relaxed. Was your access to the players on that tour, that was still a golden period where you could wander in, have coffees with people, find out what's going on and get the actual information?
Yeah, absolutely. It was mad. And I went on that tour. Ireland had a development tour to New Zealand and Samoa. So I went over and did 3 or 4 games on that and then went over to South Africa.
Okay, right, so you were away for ages.
To pick up the Lions. I probably got the last 5 games of the Lions tour. And it was just the best thing ever. And I vividly remember the likes of Delalio and various other lads sitting around on couches in foyer of the hotel and yakking with various people. And I mean, there was a press officer, just one bloke, I think, doing the whole thing on his own. But yeah, it was very laid back.
And we had a significant Irish interest. That's the ad that Guinness, I think, produced afterwards. So it's Eric Miller, it's Keith Wood, it's Jeremy Davidson. And Paul Wallace.
After that second test, remember myself and a couple of other Irish hacks wandering down to the dressing room, not in the dressing room, mind now, but we stood in the corridor outside the dressing room and waited for quite a while. And Keith Wood, I think, came out and Jeremy Davidson. And we were specifically waiting on the two of them.
Yeah.
And we got what we wanted out of them and we wandered back upstairs and there was no security and no nothing. So, all good.
A golden period.
Yeah.
Don't think this question is obvious as it sounds, but were the Lions tours different to cover? As in, was there something very apparently
absolutely
different here to everyday rugby, for want of a better term? Was different?
The parochialism is unreal.
Is it? Yeah.
Absolutely unreal. And the only subject discussed on the Lions tour is rugby and selection. So the world could be ending and you'd like a little break and you might want to talk about the US or Middle East or music or whatever. But it's rugby, rugby, rugby. And no, I don't think Jerky Elroy is worth this place. I think Colin Boog is because, you know, I'm from the same county he is. It's naked, absolutely shameless parochialism.
And did you enjoy that?
I did enjoy it, yeah, because in 97 we had a handful of fellas who were central to the whole thing.
Kind of out of nowhere in many respects. I don't think anybody thought there was going to be four Irish lads on that team.
And Jeremy Davidson was a huge success on the tour, and he was would have been looked on as an afterthought. And Keith Wood was a star. And Keith Wood, for my money, was the first bloke in Ireland to understand what pro rugby was about.
Yeah.
In terms of what it required of him and what he expected of it. And he made lifestyle changes and whatever, and said, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it really well.
I think he was a 21-year-old working for Permanent TSB or whatever the bank was at that stage, who then got the sponsorship and put him in charge of it.
Irish Permanent.
And it was like he happened to be, that was where he was working, who also happened to get the rugby thing, and it essentially was given control of the account as a 21, 22-year-old. So like it's an injection of time and the moment and the person as well. Yeah.
It's easy to overlook Keith Wood's importance because he gets the inaugural World Player of the Year, doesn't he? And so it's like, well, this guy was an exceptional talent, the freak of nature. But he actually, his role, like you said, the way you described it there, his inherent understanding of what it means to be a professional.
Yeah, and the return serve on that was what the game owed him. Right. So when he had a row, and Donal Lennon was Ireland manager at the time, and Woody had a standoff with the IRFU over contract, and Keith Wood is a very, very, very stubborn bloke. Very. And when he is quite sure of himself, and if he says, no, this is what I'm going to do, and this is why I'm going to do it, you know, a freight train wouldn't derail him. So I always admired that about him. When he had to deal with officialdom, he said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, well, it was a kick up the hole for the Lickadoos. Like,
yeah.
Oh, actually, I'm going to have to deal with people properly, as opposed to, ah, it'll be grand, here's some tickets, don't worry about it, or don't we know your family kind of thing.
It actually
like, no, you're going to treat us properly here.
Something I discovered in the research for the book as well, that he had a hand in the demise of Warren Gatland.
Mm.
And Gatty was very quick to blame Eddie O'Sullivan for everything, from the weather to whatever, you know. But Woody was involved in that as well, and he was on the record with me about that. And he actually said to me when I was interviewing him, when you interviewed me for the first book, I couldn't be 100% givish because there were sensitivities at the time that stopped me. But by all means, I'll give it to you now.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I went and spoke to Sid Miller, and Sid asked me, and I said, yeah, I think
Eddie's the man.
I think Eddie's the man.
The 2009 game is Declan Kidney. Oh, sorry, this is Leinster Munster.
The most symbolical change in rugby for the 21st century. What's saved for what, the URC semi-final 2023? Maybe earlier this year in Croke Park when Munster beat them, this was kind of it, wasn't it?
This was huge Leinster because it was, okay, Ireland against England in Croker clearly was a massive moment in Irish sport, not just in rugby, for all sorts of reasons. But this was the first time a non-test game was packed to the rafters, and instead of Leinster being the whipping boys, they were the equals of Munster or their betters on that particular day. So suddenly we had a game that was not only reaching a very wide audience in Ireland, but now we had two teams who were at the top of their game and we could really achieve things in Europe. So I think when you packaged all of that together, the colour of the day, the atmosphere and the quality of the rugby, I thought it was, you go back to earlier on, pre-pro, pre-professionalism, and talk about, oh, could we be ever be a ranked number one? You couldn't, if you turned around and said, well, you know what, we'll get into Croker and we'll pack the place out with Munster against Leinster. Nah, you'd be carted away.
It's such a significant day. Like, so this is the first proper year of the recession, 2009. And I remember watching the 06 semi-final in New York when Munster beat Leinster at Lansdowne Road.
Correct.
I think that was a semi.
Sunny, gloriously sunny day, yeah.
Yeah, and then this game, right, so Leinster win very well. Munster, I think, my memory is Munster had a penalty try that never was at the start of that game.
This game is best remembered for Johnny Sexton. Gordon Darcy scores a cracking try into Munster's right-hand corner, I'm trying to think, into the canal end. And Sexton is wired. He has come off the bench to replace Contepomi, who's gone off early with a knee injury. So Sexton is right on the edge. And as Darcy gets, he's following up, and as Darcy gets the ball down, he gives full force to Rog.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the rivalry is just simmers between those two for the next few years.
It was a marketing dream.
as palpable as well.
Oh, big time, yeah.
And you say marketing dream, but there wasn't much marketing required. It was just so natural, just let it breathe, the two of them.
Yeah. And there was always, and you never had a game where there wasn't a flare-up.
Yeah. So all of the, like the three you have, or sorry, the five in total, all great atmospheres, right? But are there similarities between, if you can remember, the 77 semi-final between Dublin and Kerry, the Lions second test in 97, and then this game, Leinster Munster 2009, Croke Park, in terms of the passion in the stadium? Are they all a bit different?
Well, I was at a different, wildly different ages. So I was
totally
77. I was I was 16 or 17 years of age, and I was on the hill, and the Dubs were being had climbed out of the grave, and it was, I don't care if the world ends tomorrow, this is the best thing ever, and we're sticking it to Kerry. Fantastic. So that was immense. My perspective when it came to Munster and Leinster, I wasn't a card carrying Leinster fan.
Right.
I was much more concerned about my club than I was about my province. And it was my job. So I was delighted that something I was writing about had become so important in Irish sport that it could command a full house in Croke Park. So it was a different feeling. And the Lions, again, it's my job. I'm loving this. I'm blessed to be here.
Yeah.
But it's my job.
Do you both remember this being the start of the start for Leinster and the start of the end for Munster?
Well, Munster were heavy favourites.
Yeah, defending champions as well.
And Leinster had scraped through after the Bloodgate game against Harlequins, mm-hmm. where they could easily have gone out. And if they had gone out, that was going to be the end of Cheka. So I don't think we thought that they were going to win three of the next four.
Well, St. Joe hadn't come yet to drive the snakes out of Ireland.
Exactly. And they only win the final, like in a really tight game.
Excuse me.
With, a very young Sexton kicking brilliantly. I think there's a couple of drop goals in the final, if memory serves. The final was actually my wedding day, so we all...
You better remember that.
We moved it around. The 23rd of May, that's why any of those Leinster players, I was like, how do you know the date? I'm like, ah.
Were speeches moved?
we waited, yeah. I think the final was a weird kind of time. But anyway, I don't think we thought that... It was brilliant that they'd beaten them finally in a big game, because they'd been annihilated after... So, Leinster put in that great performance against Toulouse, and it's the awakening of a fan base away in France in 2006. The Hickey scores those incredible tries, and they're playing brilliant, brilliant rugby. And then the next day out, Munster just go, squash, who the hell are you? Get back in your box. Mm. But then the team had won the Grand Slam, and you felt like this is kind of Munster were the power brokers in Irish rugby. So I don't know if you felt immediately, I think it's years later you realise that it's such an important sliding doors moment. Because not like Munster go away either, really. They don't win again, but they're there and they're relevant the whole way through until that team breaks up.
Correct. And by that stage, Joe was in, and Joe changed everything. Absolutely everything.
Go on.
Like, Michael Checker got them over the line in 09, but Joe changed the way they played, the way they thought about the game, the way they were managed, everything. And Kevin McLaughlin, now retired, good few years, was really good in talking to me about that in the book and Joe's effect and other people then about the level of terror he could instill. His amazing grasp of detail and his ability to regurgitate it under pressure. He was the most influential person I've seen in Irish rugby. And he'd be back.
I was going to say, rumours are always coming back.
Yeah, I'd say he'd be back in a heartbeat. He'd love to come back.
Yeah.
He'd love it.
And
he was doing a bit of love bombing when he was over here as well.
Yeah. So the Jack Dean Arbour back to South Africa.
Yeah.
Slide him back in there. Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
In what capacity?
You could have that him in.
For Jack?
Senior coach at Leinster.
Yeah. Make up the job title. Let him run the deal. Do whatever he wants.
Mm. Well. Is fixed to a motive of a word when it comes to Ulster, Connacht and Munster now? As in a requirement, they need to be fixed to come up to the level of Leinster? Because you never want to bring Leinster down.
They're not going to come up to the level of Leinster because Leinster are too far ahead and they've too many schools, which is the main provider. And for socioeconomic reasons, they're not going to come up. But they have to get a hell of a lot better than they're doing now.
Can they?
They can, but it's a real challenge on two levels, Colm. One, human resources.
Yeah.
Coaches are in short supply and two, financial resources. So you need to find the bodies and you need to find the money to give them the facilities in which they can operate. I'll give you an example. Coleraine Academy.
In Derry.
I'm not sure if I have that right. If the academy or if the school, Kieran Campbell, who would have done a lot of service with Ulster in the academy and played for London Irish and knows his way around rugby, he's taken over there about a year ago. And there's a bunch of local businessmen, I think, of whom Andrew Trimble would be one. And they've helped to put in place the structures in the school that will allow them to be competitive.
Right.
And you want another four or five of them at Ulster, yeah. And you want another four or five of them elsewhere.
Because the template is there.
Yeah. The problem is, if you go into Limerick and you go into Ortskoil Rish or you go into, Crescent is a rugby school already. But if you ask them to park everything else and focus on rugby, they may say, well, no.
Yeah, things are going okay.
Yeah, we're quite fond of hurling down this neck of the woods. So, yeah, it is a battle. The killer, and I can't answer this, sadly, we have 50 AIL clubs. So take the universities out of that because they've no underage sections. All of those clubs have youth sections. And if you take out the private school players from them, those clubs are still looking for a way in which they can meaningfully contribute to the national programme. Because currently what those clubs are doing, and I'm involved in it, is they're kind of copying what the private schools do, except they're doing it in the dark, literally, and they're doing it 2 days a week as opposed to 4 days a week.
Yeah.
So nobody has come up with a meaningful way for the clubs to plug into the grid in those youth years. So that kind of 12 to 17, 18. That is a struggle.
In hindsight, were Munster in the 2000s full of an exceptional generation of players?
Yes. And they were blessed that Declan Kidney managed them very, very well. And then they were blessed that Tony McGann came along at just the right time to help get them over the line in Europe. But, and Tony McGann says this in the book, like the door was closed to the schools. They wanted to get the schools on side and he was being told, no, that the schools are over there. We're over here. You don't worry about that.
And in fairness, like that didn't happen by accident in Leinster either. Lancaster was centrally involved and like, here's how we're going to coach our players in the academy, come in and learn how this is working. And I'm not saying giving him all the credit because obviously there's an immense amount of money in the private schools that they are able to get some of the best coaches and S&C and gym conditions in the world. But he was centrally involved and like, I'm going to go out here and meet everybody and sit with them and listen to them. And
well, he brought them in. Ideas. Like he ran any number of sessions because he's a school teacher and he loved it. And he would have all the coaches in and he'd be mic'd up on the field and he'd have a group of Leinster youth players with him and everybody went home happy.
You done?
Yeah.
My last question has nothing to do with the list, because that was great. Do you miss the beat?
No. I have to say. I missed a bit of social. but all the stuff that went with it, no. Look, I'm absolutely blessed that I got into newspapers when I did in the mid-80s. And it was a fantastic job for 35 years, whatever it was. And I wouldn't swap that for anything. And moreover, as it was happening, I genuinely wasn't taking it for granted. Like, I was not put to the pin of my collar work-wise. I was travelling all over the place. And I would always say, Jesus, am I lucky? What have I done in a previous life to deserve this?
Well, it's rare to acknowledge the good times as they're happening.
Yeah. But for whatever reason, I knew it made sense to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't have an ounce of regret that it's over. I'm perfectly happy now.
I hear the most common thing from retired sports people is the only thing that they miss is the dressing room and not the game. Is that the equivalent in journalism?
Yeah, I do miss a bit of that. But I'm still involved in coaching, it's a different dressing room and there's a lot of crack around that with other coaches as opposed to journals, where I was mixing the two prior to that. So no, I'm pretty happy with the way things have worked out.
There's a good chance this book might be sold out in Easton's on Christmas Eve. If you don't get it before then, It's called Touching Distance. Brendan Fanning, thanks a million. That was great. You had to be there. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, Les.